All right, again, my name is Jenny, and I am an alcoholic. I also like to say I'm a person in long-term recovery because I like to emphasize that recovery piece. It's really important for me to remember where I came from, but also always dream for more. And so that's kind of what I found in this fellowship, absolutely. I did have something I was going to read, but let me see. Okay. So an illness, this is in the Big Book, page 18. And an illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it is an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile and engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and wives, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. The good part is that we are like passengers of the ship, right? And so we get to come together in the solution. And what my fellowship looks like is solution-oriented, always. So a little bit about where I came from. Only child, born in Louisville, Kentucky. Amazing childhood. But my parents definitely liked to party, and that's how I know Taylor. My parents drank with Taylor's mom, and it's so cool, like, how we met, because I got sober in 2008, and my parents were still drinking, and, like, you know, we're able to kind of juggle that two lives in one kind of thing. I was not. I like to go hard. So, you know, arrested at 18, you know, caught several charges throughout the years, just, you know, pretty much on a downward spiral. So by the time I asked for help in 2008, you know, I was pretty much done, but it was an emotional bottom. You know, I had already served out like a 2-year probation. Didn't really have anything over my head at that point, but I hated myself. And the point of my recovery was, like, I wanted to find joy again. You know, I had lost that. And it was kind of cool because after I got sober in South Florida, I found out that my parents had actually started going to meetings back in Louisville. And so my parents started going to AA at the Pigeon's Roost. And it was so neat to have, like, this completely different dynamic within our family. And I moved back from South Florida to Louisville in 2013, and my mom was, you know, really active in AA and in a women's group called Stepping Stones. And she said, "You've got to meet this girl, Taylor. She's awesome." And she really is. she's the most beautiful, spirited person. And she is an example of part of the fellowship that we crave. So I found people in the 12-step fellowship that were just like me. And for my whole life, I wanted that. I craved that, to just not feel different. I wanted to feel a part of. And I remember one of the first meetings that I went to in rehab in 2007, it was almost like I could breathe. I was like, I was home. And, you know, it's kind of funny now looking back. I think the speaker was talking about, like, being on probation and getting locked up and drinking all hours of the night and other things that go along with, you know, what we do. And it wasn't like I was a taboo. I belonged, and I wasn't an outcast, and I wasn't this bad person. I was a sick person. And then she started talking about a solution, and that, you know, she had, you know, was living in this sober living and had, you know, this amount of time in sobriety and had so many friends. And I immediately was attracted to that. And at 24 years old, I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God. Thank God for that. I mean, I really do believe that God touched my soul during those first few months and years to where I'm fully, fully aware that I can't have just one. I can't drink. I break out in handcuffs and harm people that I love, you know, and that's the bottom line. So I went from, you know, a homeless, helpless, couldn't keep a job, couldn't stay in school, bankrupt person to, like, I get to teach in a college today. You know, I own a home. I have a beautiful family. And the greatest gift is peace of mind and a God conscience and friends that, like, really want the best for me. There's no ulterior motives. Like, I think one of the greatest gifts is friendship. And the friends that I found are in the fellowship. And it's like, we've known each other our whole lives. Even if, you know, it's somebody that I've recently met, you're instantly bonded. You know, it's the sinking ship. Like, you're instantly connected because you understand the struggle. Not everybody understands the struggle. I also work in a hospital today. Not a lot of people understand alcoholism. People judge and make preconceived notions and don't view us as humans sometimes. And I've been guilty of that. But I get to be like that light. And, you know, I didn't tell my coworkers right away when I started getting into the healthcare field that I used to smoke crack cocaine. But eventually, you know, after they saw my work ethic and they saw that I am a good person and that I do the next right thing and that I live my life with integrity and that I just want to help these patients because I want to give them genuine care, then they maybe softened their view of what an alcoholic is, you know? And that's the hope, right? Like, I'm no better than the person that's still drinking. I just have a few days in between that. And you know, the fellowship, whew. So Taylor and I and our group of girlfriends, some live in Lexington, some in, where does Cassie live? She's like forever away. And Louisville, and we all have, you know, a group message that we're constantly in, and we get to go on a houseboat every year. And then my sponsor actually bought a marina. I mean, it's wild. Like, you can't even make this up. But she bought a marina, and she has a 2020 Mastercraft ski boat that she doesn't need a man to back that trailer. And it is amazing. So we go out and we have a blast, try to as many times a year as we can. Usually we get one good solid 4 days, but like, that is what I envision heaven is, the peace and just the sun. And, you know, we don't need drugs and alcohol. Like, the fridge has alcohol in it. 'Cause, you know, our girlfriend's parents aren't alcoholics. They can drink with impunity. But never in the 10 years or however 15 long year, whatever, how many years we've been going, do we even think about that, because we're fully armed with the facts about ourselves and we don't lack anything to make it a better time. And that is the fellowship that I crave. It is dancing, it is laughing hysterically, telling stories about the crazy times that I did have, and some in recovery, you know, because I haven't always been tip-top health, mental health in recovery, you know, but we can look back and like laugh about those things, you know, and they understand, because we're all, you know, not the, I tell my sponsees, you know, you're kind of shopping in the dented can aisle, like we're not the epitome of mental health, and that's okay, because we have fun with it and try to make the best out of it, and really, you know, I wouldn't want it any other way. I really wouldn't. Like, God has brought me to where I am today, and I needed every single experience, every single heartache, every single breakup, every single downfall, rejection, to get to where I'm okay with Jenny today, you know? And I turned 40 last summer, and, you know, I've spent the majority of my life without drugs and alcohol, you know? And I'm not missing out. I have a toolbox where I can accept things that I can't change. And I get to practice love and tolerance, even when I don't want to. But eventually comes around where, like, it's God orchestrating my life, and it feels so smooth, you know, where it used to be just treading water against the wave, right? And now it's like everything just kind of falls into place as long as I'm doing the next right thing. We're actually finishing up 12 steps doing the Al-Anon workbook, and it's my several of my sponsees, and you know, just so many different ways in the 16 years I've been sober have I been able to seek God through the steps. And what's cool about the Pathways to Recovery Al-Anon workbook is that I get to step back and try to see myself from an Al-Anon perspective, and what my family went through, and what people may see me as today. And you know, there's so many different perspectives with the disease of alcoholism and recovery that I'm excited to learn. I'm excited to find ways and means to God's will, you know, because it just gets better. Like even just a few years ago, you know, I had to move back into my parents' house at 30 years old because my daughter's father started shooting heroin. And I had a good 5 years of recovery. And so in 2013, I turned 30. I moved back into my parents' basement with my two-year-old after I was fully self-supporting in South Florida after going to rehab and getting sober. And it was like starting all over, you know, but what was cool is that I found a fellowship in a whole different city. And it was the city that I used pretty hard drugs and alcohol in. But what I found is that AA in Louisville, Kentucky was every bit as powerful and God-centered as it was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where I had been. And I found the fellowship that I craved in Louisville, Kentucky, broken, rejected. You know, I was able to go back to school, you know, get a degree in radiology, expunge my criminal record, become the mother that my daughter deserves, and now I have the most amazing life. My husband also has 10 years. He'll have 11 in July. And, you know, we took a meeting into a treatment center together last Wednesday. He has sponsees. I have sponsees. We live Alcoholics Anonymous. My husband's father has going on 30 years in AA. His wife has 18. My dad is coming up on, I think he'll have 15 on June 1st, 15 years of sobriety. So we're just completely surrounded by people who want a better life without alcohol. And I can't imagine any other way. You know, not too long ago, my daughter, who is 12 and starting to be quite a handful, said, you know, Mom, I'm really glad that you don't drink. You know, so even though, like, she's never really around drugs and alcohol, like, she sees enough to know that she does not want that, at least for her parents. And while my parents did the best they could, you know, I think that that affected me, not having sober, present parents. So, I mean, that's part of why I stay sober, is like I get to show her a new way of life, you know, different from maybe, you know, the parents of her friends, or, you know, just other family dynamics that she's around, and that's already attractive to her. And I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful that she knows I'm there every single night, present, safe, running her ass to dance every single day. But, you know, I get to do those things. I get to do those things. Tomorrow night we have a competition, dance, yay. You know, and again, it's like, it's a whole thing, but that those are things that, like, she appreciates and that I know will stay with her forever, is a present and sober mother and father, because she calls my husband daddy and has for a long time. It's just, it's a beautiful life. I wish I could just smack some people across, you know, with the happy, joyous, and free movement we have going on. But it doesn't work like that. Like, they have to want it. And some are harder than others. You know, I've been blessed to have some solid sponsees. But at the beginning, I mean, those first 8-10 years, I mean, they're not always willing, you know, to do the work, because it took work to get here. Like, the fellowship is amazing. It's awesome, and it helped keep me accountable and keep me coming back, and so much fun. But, like, if I hadn't done the work and obtained a psychic change, that I wouldn't be standing here. But I'm so blessed. And like I said, I wouldn't change anything for the world. So thank you so much for allowing me to talk a little bit about fellowship.
Thank you. I don't think I can keep up with Guy's volume. How's this tonight? Is this all right? I remember when Guy spoke in our home group a few years ago. my name is David. I'm an alcoholic. I just said that my home group is here in Lexington, and those people scared the pants off of me. That's a really polite way to put it. I've been sitting in meetings for a very long time. I'd been sober for longer than some of them. They didn't have anything to tell me. And I tell you what, sometimes you learn what not to do, and I had to do that the hard way. You know, I was in a meeting last night, and it was the beginning of We Agnostics was the topic, and I remembered, like, with a shudder, actually, we hope that some of you aren't as prejudiced or hard-headed as some of us were. And that's a lot of my first decade or so in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my sobriety date's August 23rd, 2005. It wasn't the date of my last drink. I threw something out the car window because I thought I got caught. And I didn't feel good about it. And I was on the way to dinner with my mother. It's her birthday, so thanks, Mom. She looked down at the, so that's, and that was a little over 18 years ago. And what's happened in that amount of time, when I first started going to meetings quite some time ago, the guys in my first home group didn't think I was going to survive, and I didn't understand because I thought I was the greatest, you know, piece of crap in the center of the universe. And when I started going to meetings, and it was December of that year, it didn't matter what year it was, I smelled like a bar floor, complete with cigarettes, urine, and vomit. And I went into a very well-dressed meeting on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. That's where I was living. And I thought I did not belong there because there was a lot of expensive clothes in that room. Those people had taken a bath. I had not. Those people had food. I didn't. And I was surrounded by people, and I didn't understand why they wanted to talk to me. I didn't realize at first that I had sat down beside a homeless schizophrenic who was genuinely crazy. And for a long time, I wondered whatever the hell happened to Robert, because I thought he was the one that really belonged there. I could not grasp that the people in that room may well have had exactly what I had, but I couldn't see that there was any hope of getting any better. That was a while back. And I was telling my sponsor this, speaking of fellowship, he's not able to be here. Whatever the situation is that's going to take him into surgery before too long is really bothering him. And the same with his wife, and I care deeply about them both, and I have for years. So I could go on about the other people in my life. And that's happened, one of our friends says, little by slowly, but little by little. And I was one of the people, I think I'm referred to in the 12 and 12. Yeah, it's just me. That people really annoyed me, and I took pleasure in that. I had no idea that was fear. My God, it was just so full of it. But I could tell you about a lot of the people that mean stuff to me now. And my sponsor sort of jabs me and says, easy to take that stuff for granted, didn't it, David? And I thought, thanks. Okay, I got it. Good. I hear you loud and clear. Sometimes better than others. But when I was first struggling, I lived by the building where I went to school, and that was on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And there's a little office that some of you know about on Riverside Drive right there. It's called GSO. And there's I was literally diagonally across the street. And a friend of mine quoted the line in the service manual, said, oh, so you were the drunk stumbling in the dark across the street. And so, I didn't know what she was talking about. I'd never heard of a service manual at that point. But yes, and once when I was getting ready to travel, I went for an international meeting list. And it's like, there's a whole bunch of people there. I mean, that made quite an impression on me, and that was a few years ago. There weren't meetings where I was going. And people said, David, start a meeting. I didn't know what to do, how to do it. I didn't know what our instructions were. I was slinging slogans, shining a seat, faking it till I made it, so full of crap my eyes are still brown. And there were a lot of days, even then, when I wasn't drinking, I didn't know if I was going to go to work or jump in front of a train. And I was desperate for you to think that I had all my shit together. And that was the farthest thing from the truth. Those early years of me bouncing off the walls in Manhattan, I have no doubt saved my life. I was with a lot of other people doing the same thing. But I was joking with somebody up front earlier. I can't tell you the number of times people said, yeah, I was going to kill myself, but I went to Perry Street instead. That's a meeting in the village. And I was there. Oh, man, it's about the size of this little section over here. And there, you know, used to be cat food. Is that what the cat food cans? Yeah, they were our ashtrays. And they told me that the ABCs of AAs was Ashtrays, Brooms, and Chairs. And I had no idea that there was anything about service other than that. But fellowship, to me, was the friends that I made in meetings. And it was, if I saw somebody at my lunch meeting and at the Thursday night meeting and at the Saturday morning meeting, they became friends. And all I could grasp was that they were headed the same direction I was. Bill wrote in Bill's story that his mental health sloped like a, fell down like a ski jump or something. That's a really polite way to put what's going on with me. One guy really took me, I won't say under his wing, but he sort of became friends. We were at a meeting downtown in Manhattan or something. And he said, David, you know, you can go to the grocery store right here and take a small bag of groceries with you, home on the subway, a 20-minute ride on the number one train, uptown. And I needed people to tell me stuff like that. I needed somebody at work, and I didn't like this, to say that I needed to wash my clothes. I didn't like that either. I thought they needed to mind their own business. But I needed to wash my clothes. I don't look like that today, and I don't smell like that, Greg will be glad to say. I have a pretty good idea what I look like today. And I didn't get there here today because I thought it was a good idea or that I wanted to. I wanted you out of my face, and I wanted the pain to stop, and I didn't care if I had to be dead to do it. That was just fine with me. Bill wrote in Bill's story that pretty soon they were going to have to call the Undertaker. And he was basically okay with that. That was the only thing that I could imagine that would stop the pain. And it didn't seem, not drinking during the days that I was able to not drink didn't answer that question for me. That pain didn't go away. And so one of our friends here in Lexington says, apparently I've got a drinking problem that not drinking doesn't fix. And I started to get scared. I didn't want to admit that. So I spent a long time just repeating what I had heard in one meeting, assuming that I would get the results that you did. I suppose that the people doing that stuff had probably been working 12 steps. Three legacies, I didn't know, had no idea. I thought that didn't belong in AA. I mean, I had no idea what they were talking about. I ended up doing some pretty good work for a company that I wanted to work for in a building that everybody in here knows the name of this building. It doesn't matter. And I worked in there for one day. And it's not like I got fired. It was just one short little hire. And I can tell you what it was, but it doesn't matter. And I didn't have any problems. And I didn't understand. I didn't know what that meant. And I needed somebody who had sponsored enough people, who'd been sober for long enough and talked to people probably all over this country. And he said, David, everything that you ever wanted, needed, worked for, or hoped for, you managed to stack up around you for one day. And in that one day, you didn't need God. I'm going to cry. So how in the world does this guy know this? I wasn't able to look at my life and tell this. And he said, what happened after that? And I said, I was back on 56th Street. Everything I touched turned to crap. My life was burning down around me, and I didn't know why I was alive if I couldn't drink. And he said, you're damn right. I said, would you please help me? That was this guy. He's no longer with us. He died of cancer a few years ago, which makes me sad. But he carried a message that I'm going to say I didn't get. And I don't think that it's hard to believe that I hadn't been heard enough. I would tell you just exactly how badly mangled I was if you would sit down and listen. How much was everybody else's fault and what they did and you'd drink too. And God, I hear that all the time in meetings now. And when that didn't work, I moved to my parents' house when I was 42. I'd done the same thing with work overseas, and it was brilliant. God, I loved being in Berlin. And as soon as I came back to the States, it's like, fuck, I'm back to being David again. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I saw a friend's bottle of vodka one day, and this was in 2005 or thereabouts, and I was terrified. I didn't know if I was going to drink it or not. So I went to Gratz Park's only place in Lexington where I knew there was a meeting. And I was just looking for a meeting list. And there was a women's meeting going on downstairs, and somebody yelled, "Get out!" And I learned a lot right then. Sometimes what not to do, have I ever said that? And but I learned, well, anyway, I said, I just need a meeting schedule. And a very nice woman brought me up a meeting schedule. And I went to a meeting where my grand sponsor was talking. And I thought I'd been attending meetings for a number of years. And I couldn't even talk when I got there. And he passed a meeting list around and wrote his name on it and his number. And I said, "That son of a bitch is 12-stepping me. I've been sober longer than he is. I'll show him." And what he said was that, "I'm going to another meeting tomorrow night. Why don't you meet me there?" And I went, I'll be there. He saved my life. And a friend of his, they knew that I had absolutely no idea what was wrong with me, and all the stuff that I had repeated that everybody else had said didn't produce any sort of change in me that was long-lasting or had any real depth or weight, I guess. I don't know. But since then, there were some folks in that meeting when I was ready to listen that had a solution that I was desperate for, and I asked my sponsor, "Would you please just tell me what I have to do?" And there was always a big book near that guy, and so he said, "We're just going to do what's right in here." I said, "Okay, I'm good. I'm good with that." And he started at the blank page on the beginning, and basically told me that's where I was. And I don't think he asked me many questions right then. And we got to the preface, and at the end of the preface, there are two questions to ask yourself: if you felt like that, and ask yourself if you've experienced that. Find it and tell me what I left out. That'll be fun. Add that to your bingo card. And he said, that's an easy instruction to read over and not even realize you've read an instruction. And so all the way through this, one of my favorite examples is in the doctor's opinion. These men weren't drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And he said, "David, what does that look like in your life?" I said, "Where do you want me to begin? I have no idea." And my grand sponsor said, "David, what's your abnormal reaction to alcohol? These are the people that loved me. I didn't understand that. They had a solution that they knew I did not understand, that I had basically been so full of myself, worldly clamors mostly within myself, politics, sex, religion, work, money, anger, fear, resentments, name it. I was full of it." So in the first step, my grand sponsor asks me, "What's your experience with an abnormal reaction to alcohol?" And I said, "I passed out on the kitchen floor. Just petting the dog. Hours later, the dog's gone. It's me and the gin on the kitchen floor." And he said, "That's a normal reaction to alcohol, David. Anybody that drinks as much as you did is likely to pass out. You're lucky you're home when it happened. David, what's your abnormal reaction to alcohol?" And I said, "I puke. I'm a volume drinker and I'm a volume puker." And he said, "David, that's a normal reaction to alcohol. Anybody that drinks as much as you did is likely to vomit. David, what is your abnormal reaction to alcohol?" And I said, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And he said, "David, when you drink, do you require more?" And it was very easy, yes. And it wasn't about the lady at work. It wasn't about the asshole cab driver. It wasn't about anybody else. It wasn't what was or wasn't in my bank account. It wasn't what the conversation I had or didn't have with any of my family members. When I drank, I wasn't able to control the amount I took. And that began to change. I started to think, is it really possible that even after all these years, I never believed it, that all the stuff that I thought was such a secret was going to take me to my grave, that these are what these people have recovered from. And when I was parroting one thing from one meeting to the next, I had no idea. I was so full of self and fear, I couldn't even see straight. The fellowship took on a really different meaning for me. That guy that explained to me that I could go to the grocery store, that might sound really preposterous. I needed somebody. I was basically non-functional to that degree. He won a Tony Award? I didn't know that. I had no idea who he was. He was my buddy Michael. I'd had a different experience some years earlier. In my lunch meeting, one of the guys that I was buddies with died of an overdose. And I used to be jealous. I couldn't imagine life with alcohol. I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. And I didn't know that that was in our book. And it was really clear to me when Troy had died, there was something alive and present. Gotta get my tissues out here. Something alive and present in my body that was no longer living or present in Troy's body. And my definition of God changed, and I didn't like it. But shit, I'm not an atheist after all. It would have been a lot easier, I think. And if you have a 12 and 12, all that stuff's absolutely right. And I, thankfully, there's a solution. So I started going to this meeting regularly on Wednesday night, and these people would read a little passage out of our book, and they would tell what that step is, how they did it, how they worked it with their sponsor, the change it had in their life, and how they share that message with others. And I'm absolutely not the same. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's gone through my mind, you know, today. Oh, I got to do this and sound good. Well, thankfully, all that crap's gone out. I mean, so I was sitting here asking, please direct my thinking. And because my mind doesn't do very good on its own. And, you know, when somebody says, I'm just going to do the next right thing, I go, how the hell do you know what that is? And I was telling a sponsee when we got to this, we read the words, no, thank you, Paul. Tissues. Under these conditions. It's like, was that page on? Page 87 or 88? So we got a few instructions to do to get there. And one guy used to scare the hell out of me when he said, AA's written down. It's easy to know where you are, you know, what page you're on, what you're doing. Today I can honestly say that, yes, where I am with this sponsee. One sponsee has been very ill for a long time, in and out of the hospital. Breaks my heart. I wasn't able to go visit. Another sponsee has been very sick for a long time. One of my sponsees says exactly what I've got. Didn't hear from him for a few days. I knew. Right, there he is. I sent him a message today. Man, you're not alone. I made a note today on page 164. I'll be done in just a minute. Because something really occurred to me. And God will show you how to create the fellowship, you see. I would have thought I wanted it. I wanted to look as good as you did. I wanted to sound as good as you did. And it occurs to me, this thing is in the 10th step. And I've heard a lot of people that I trust because I've seen their lives. And it's not that they read it and talk about it. The difference is that they do it. And that absolutely terrified me. Because I was like the kid that never did my homework, but I was jealous of people that did. And that was kind of the same here. Until I was really clear, and my sponsor helped clarify this for me, that I'm just out of my mind. But anyway, my life was on the line whether I was drinking or not. And that was true. So the thing that I was thinking about, these people talking about the 10th step in my home group, the instruction is easy to read over, like most of this is. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? Look up the word function. My sponsor told me to keep a dictionary handy. I was so smart I needed a dictionary. It's still right by my rocking chair, which is my dad's rocking chair, by the way, which is very sweet. Function's like a job. But if I'm full of selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, or fear, I am blocked, completely blocked. And so first time through the steps, for me, and I think with anybody, it just makes sense to pay attention to the mechanics. What are the actual instructions here? And now I can see that when I'm full of fear, which is the story of most 63 years, I'll save you the math, most of my life, I mean, I can't tell where I'm coming or going. I headed to work today. They had no idea how right I was. And then later, it's like, oh, really? I'll do the other thing. That'll make more sense. And as though it was my idea. But with self being the block to that, you know what the state of mind that precedes the first drink sounds like? I'm good. Got it. Thanks. That's the state of mind that precedes. What's my experience with that? I'm full of it. The other day, I was talking to somebody about we are his agents. And the thought between fellowship, we are his agents, and complete surrender started to become the same thought. That when I was so full of self, I really couldn't see straight. It was selfishness. And I wasn't interested in you or anything you had or did. I wasn't interested in anything you, in helping. I remember basically telling my sponsor, you have obviously haven't listened to a word I've said. I'm not here for that. And I've watched some other guys surrender, and it's, I've told them that their surrender is observable, and my sponsor's there to point out the same thing to me. And my life bears absolutely no resemblance to what it is on the times that I thought I was just ashamed of myself because I hadn't even washed my clothes. But my life is entirely different, and that's a result of all you carrying a message. Thank you.
I'm Greg. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank the esteemed panelists that are up here with me. My sobriety date is November 20th of 1989. My home group is, I've got two actually, Parkside Promises, God's Backyard, and then my sponsor is Charlie Y. And my sponsor for my first 25 years was Stan N. So anyway, you know, I remember going to my second meeting, I think it was, and there was a guy that was sitting there, and he said, you know, be careful how high you put a guy on a pedestal, because the clearer you'll see their ass. And when he said that, I sat there and I said, you know, I understand that. I get that. You know, it was kind of like something clicked. And then this next guy, I went to another meeting, and this guy told this story about this guy that took a grandfather clock into the watch shop, the clock shop, and had it repaired. And the guy said, well, it'd be $600 to deliver that. And he said, no, don't deliver it. I'll pick it up. I'll take it to the house. So he goes and he gets it on his back, and he's walking gingerly down the alley, and he's just walking along, and all of a sudden, boom, out of that alley comes a drunk and just knocks him flat. The clock shatters into 1,000 pieces, laying there just busted up, and he looks at the drunk and he goes, look what you did, look at my clock. And he goes, well, why don't you wear a wristwatch like everybody else? You know, I got that too. I understood that. The way I understood that was when I was 19 years old, I got arrested because I had a loud muffler. I got arrested for a warrant that was out for my arrest. And so I had this warrant out for my arrest. And the cop says, you know, I got a warrant out for your arrest. I got to take you downtown. I said, I know. And he said, well, I've got to lock you up. I got to handcuff you. I got to do all this. I said, well, man, hold on. Before you do that, I got to go to the restroom. And I woke up in the back of the cruiser. My head was pounding, just aching, just busted up. And I'm like, man, what happened? And his literal words to me were, you little bastard, you pissed all over me. And he was writing the ticket on the hood of the car, and I'd unzipped my fly in a blackout and urinated on his leg. And he hit me in the head with a billy club and threw me in the back of the car. So I'm in the jail cell all weekend, okay? I'm in there all weekend. And my parents rightly left me in there. And I'm trying to trade the boiled eggs for fried bologna because I don't like the boiled eggs. And the whole time I'm there, I'm thinking, if I'd just gotten that muffler fixed, I wouldn't be here. That's alcoholic thinking. If you don't understand alcoholic thinking, that's alcoholic thinking. I got dropped into a group of people that had that kind of thinking. You know, I looked this up just to see what it said, because I really wanted to say, okay, you know, I think I understand everything, pretty intelligent guy. And I looked this up, and it says, crave, to long for, want greatly, desire eagerly, to require, need. Let that fall over you for a few minutes. Let that just wash over you for a minute. I had no idea I was craving a fellowship. None. Let me tell you something. There was nothing in my mind. They pulled me, after I came out of that little incident, okay? My papaw picks me up because my parents don't even want to see me. My papaw picks me up. I'm crying like a baby because I'm full of remorse, you know. And he says, oh, honey, it's okay that you send my mail to this place. And I'm like, what's that got to do with anything? You're not where I am. So they take me to the house to have an intervention. So my parents are divorced, recently divorced. And I see both cars there. Okay, now when you see both cars of recently divorced parents at a residence, it's about to go down. And I come walking in the house, and they're trying to 12-step me with nobody in recovery present. How do you think that went? I literally went into the bathroom. I knew my grandmother was going to get her hair done Friday morning at 10 o'clock. This was a Tuesday. And I unlocked the bathroom window, knowing that I could push it up and climb in and steal her valium while they're trying to 12-step me. This is my plan. Okay? And I did. I opened that window and I shinned in there on Friday and I got her value. Because you were not going to tell me when they started proposing to me, oh, we'll send you to Hawaii, we'll send you the greatest, we'll send you out to Betty, we'll send you to here, we'll send you to there. And I'm like, but you don't understand. What will I do? How will I get out of bed tomorrow and go through the day? I had to have the drink that morning. When that drink hit the back of my throat and went down the back of my spine, my thought was, okay, I can meet the day. Let's go. That's why I think it's so great in A Vision for You. They say, do you have a sufficient substitute? Well, you had better damn well have one. You had better have one. Because I didn't know how I was going to make it. How was I going to live? How was I going to take care of these fears that were driving my whole life? How was I going to take care of these inferiorities that were all over me? How was I going to address all of these things that were tearing me apart inside? The bottle was but a symbol, is what it says in the book. We had to get down to causes and conditions. I didn't know how to get there. You all did. You all did. No wonder I crave this fellowship. No wonder I want to be here. You showed me a way out. You showed me. It says at the beginning of the doctor's opinion, it says right there at the beginning, the subject presented in this book we seem to believe to be paramount. Paramount, that means above anything, for those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. Well, what is the subject in the book? It's going to beg you to ask that question, isn't it? I can tell you it ain't alcohol. It's getting to this power. How do I get there? I had no idea the power was what I was craving, but I started craving the fellowship because you showed me how to get to the power. You showed me how to get into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of a sudden, I started believing, well, maybe there is something bigger than me. You know, I had a sponsor who looked at me. He says, you know what the real definition of insanity is? It's the idea that you were designed to run your life. That's a real definition of insanity. You are nuts. Somebody like you running your life. My God. So then I come into this idea of saying, okay, I'll make a decision. I don't know what you are. I don't know what you... You know, it's really funny, though. Don't you think it's really funny the way they write it? As we understood him. As we understood him. Read the big book. See how they understood him. Pick the book up and see how they understood this power. Don't start willy-walling around. Pick it up. Read it. Get to it. And then do this four-step. Purge yourself of this darkness. And watch the light come in. Start to feel buoyant. Start to be able to look in the mirror. Shave in the mirror. Hell, walk around naked. Not care that you're fat. Listen, you all, let me tell you something. You all think Hughlett got up here and was loud? I'm sorry, guy. Was up here and loud? I roomed with him for 8 days in Scotland a week ago. Or just, 6 months ago. Try that on. And you know what? We walked around our room naked and nobody cared. We could care less. There's a visual for you. That's fellowship. That is fellowship. Listen. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know why I love Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'll just name them out. I'll name them out till I'm blue in the face. Because of Mary, who loved me when I was at the Newman Center and took care of me. Okay? Because of Linda and Mike, who took care of me. It would have been their anniversary this Sunday. Okay? My heart hurt for Linda. When she told me that. I knew Mike well. Mike was good to me. Linda's been good to me. These people raised me, took care of Dee. I mean, Dee, man, when I came in, Dee and Lee Greer drove me around. I didn't know whether to wind my ass or wipe my watch. And they took care of me. That's what the fellowship does. We nurture each other. We love each other. We care for each other. And we watch those individuals come to care for themselves and love themselves. Man, there is no greater thing in the world than to experience that. Nothing. If you tell me there is, I'll tell you you're lying. I'm telling you right now, doing my fifth step with my sponsor might have been greater than the birth of my first child, my first hole in one, it was spiritual. And then 6 and 7 are just ongoing. I'm just a walking character defect. I mean, I just ain't. You know what? And the day that I think I'm not is the day that I probably got a bottle in my hand. So I had a guy tell me one time, I'll never forget it. He said, if you're ever in a meeting and you hear somebody, if they start to talk about how humble they are or how honest they are, get your ass up and run out of the room as hard as you can. I'll never forget that. I am a man in need of a Savior. Stan told me when I got here, he said, we're the damnedest people I ever saw. He said, you know, we get here and hell, we don't even have a pair of shoes, they're slip-on. He said, and then we learn how to time. Then we might get some clothes. They might fit pretty well. He said, and then, you know, next thing you know, you get a car to drive around, and then you get a house, and get a significant other, and you all of a sudden you start to make a little money, and you got kids, and you got to go do baseball and football and basketball and all of this. And he said, you leave the very thing that gave it to you, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, butcher, never forget to leave the dance with who brung you. He said, God brought you to AA. Never forget that. AA brought you to the dance, and the dance is life. And buddy, I dance. I live life. I live it to its fullest. My mother told me the other day, she said, honey, I've never seen anybody like it. She said, you're living your best life. I said, mother, I'm not done till he tells me I am. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life. Most of the things that I do in my life, the people that I do it with are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's who I want to be with. That's where I want to be. It is the fellowship that I crave. And I'm forever grateful to the women and the men that came before me. And before I shut this down, I do want to say one thing. And I said it today in a text, and I'm going to say it again. I think that these young people are to be commended. They are absolutely the hope and the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what they have done here, putting this convention together, operating this thing, there's some old timers that are involved, but the majority of them, you look around, it's young people. And by God, I think they're to be commended, and you need to give them a hug and say, thank you the hell for stepping up. Because you know what us old timers will do? I've made my coffee. I've done my shit. You know. Hell no, don't ask me to do that. I'm a, my God. I'll just sit back and tell you what you're doing wrong. Thank you. Thank you for asking me to be on this panel. It's a privilege. You know, I always wondered why Bill, they're actually talking about Bill and the doctor's opinion where the doctor says this guy asked for the privilege to tell his story, to come in and tell his story. Why would he have considered it a privilege to come in and tell stories about himself that unless he got to testify? It was a testimony to this God that had changed his life, these steps that had affected him and brought him into a relationship with a power greater than himself that would allow him to help others come to know that same thing. What did he say when he was laying in the bed? Thought came to him, well, maybe there's others out there who might want this same thing. Maybe I could take that to them. Wow, what a God. Thank you for letting me be here.